This holiday, BMW has reunited three members of the family at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. The Agile X3, engineered for any adventure. The plug-in hybrid X5, commanding the streets with unmatched presence. And the all-electric i4, charging into the future with impeccable performance. Hurry in to find what powers your journey at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details. It's better
over here. After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at T-Mobile.com/keep and switch.
Up to four lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device credit service ported 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.
Hey, y'all, it's Chip Patterson from the Cover 3 Podcast, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network. College football is about to enter its first ever 12-team playoff era, so join me, along with Tom Fornelli, Danny Cannell, and Bud Elliott, as we drop new episodes five times a week to close out the year. We've got reactions, bracket breakdowns, and best bets for these matchups with championship stakes. Follow and listen to the Cover 3 Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for joining us this morning for Total Information AM here on KMOX. I'm Megan Lynch, and we welcome back Peter Castor. He's a presidential historian with a focus on the founders of our nation. As we transition to a new administration in Washington, D.C., Castor has some historical perspective on that process that actually goes back to the first decades of our government. Welcome in to KMOX. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about what kind of government the founders actually created in those first decades. I don't think we think about what it took for them to put this together.
No, I don't think we do. A lot of people at some point get assigned the Federalist Papers, but that's, of course, about a plan to build a government, not the government they actually built. So when George Washington began as the first president in 1789, his first job was kind of an HR job. He had to hire a whole bunch of people to fill a whole bunch of new positions, and that became a big challenge for him and his successors because they thought so much was at stake. They needed a government that would preserve the representative nature of the United States, but they saw threats and challenges in every direction. So they wanted a government that was secure, that was robust, that was nimble, a lot of terms that people now would certainly understand.
Was it as political a process as it is today?
Not nearly in the same way. Well, first of all, when this started, there weren't two political parties, but there were a lot of people jockeying for office. You get people writing to the president. You get some people writing saying, you know, I would be happy to be a Supreme Court justice or Secretary of State, and you should do this for me because we know each other. And then you get other people who had never met him. There are hundreds of people who came to New York City, which was the capital in 1789, wrote personally to the president saying, I fought in the revolution. I have all these children. Please hire me for a low-level office in the customs service. So it's all over the place.
And something that we wouldn't necessarily think of a president
doing,
filling those positions. So you have actually devoted a lot of time to collecting and digitizing a lot of the records from 1789 to 1829.
That's correct.
You know, what were some of the things that surprised you as you started going through those archives?
The first thing that surprised me is just how many people served in the federal government. I have records of about 38,000 people who served as federal employees, and that does not include enlisted personnel in the military who are much more difficult to recapture. So it's a federal government that in many ways was much larger than people now tend to imagine. They keep thinking, oh, the founders wanted this small government. Well, it was definitely smaller than the government we have now. But at the same time, I think it's a lot larger and much more capable than people now would think. So that was the first surprise. And it's not all men. So there are men and women serving in the government. This at a time when women couldn't vote. Women, in many cases, couldn't own property. It was an incredibly unequal society. But there are these women who show up who were running lighthouses, who were maintaining post offices, who were serving as some of the first nurses in maritime hospitals. So they show up here and there, and I hadn't expected to find them either.
When we talk about the first federal agencies, how many were there and what did they cover?
So at least this part is very simple. The first agencies, in order of their creation, were the State Department, the Treasury Department, the War Department, and in fact, the succession of office now proceeds in the order in which the agencies were created. So after the President, Vice President, Speaker of the House, President Pro Tem of the Senate, it's then the Secretary of State, Secretary of Treasury, Secretary of Defense. But the other agency that didn't actually attend cabinet meetings but was immensely important was the Post Office. The Post Office at any given time had about half of the civil employees. And we now take postal delivery for granted, but in the 1790s, people believed it was an absolutely essential federal office. They believed that the Post Office proved that the Union existed. For many Americans, their most direct interaction with the federal government was when they went to a post office to pick up their mail, because there was no federal income tax at that time, so they didn't deal with the IRS. Depending on where you lived, you would never see, you might never see the Army. You might never deal with these other agencies, but the post office was everywhere.
How centralized was the government?
So then, as now it was centralized, there were every agency had a central office in the nation's capital. And the capital was in New York from 1789 to 1790. It was then in Philadelphia from about 1791 to 1800. And then it moved to Washington, D.C. The big difference is that the central administrative office staffs were very small. It was a very decentralized government in terms of the number of people. And I think that created more problems than it solved. One of my favorite examples of this was we were talking about how people got hired. And so I was working in the National Archives many years ago, and they had a record that said nominations during the Jefferson administration. And there was literally an ammo box. That's where it was stored. And it was these letters that would go to the Senate, because almost every civil and military office required advice and consent. And it's written in Thomas Jefferson's hand. And you would get something that says, I nominate so-and-so. I nominate Albert Gallatin to be Secretary of the Treasury, and I nominate so-and-so to be a second lieutenant in the United States Army. That is not a great use of the president's time and energy. So the decentralized notion, which seemed very appealing, seemed very cost-effective, was in fact a huge drain, and it limited the ability of government to respond to the challenges that it faced.
How long did it take to establish maybe standard operating procedures where things weren't done so directly and hands-on?
Right. So I'll begin by saying that at the beginning, this came together pretty quickly. I'm struck by the fact that by 1790, 1791, remember, this is less than two years after the government came into being, most of its procedures were in place. And they remained in place until the late 18-teens, when principally John Quincy Adams and John C. Calhoun, the Secretary of State and the Secretary of War, both sought to reform their agencies. But government as we think about it now, which has very elaborate hierarchies and structures, that's really an invention of the late 19th century. Bureaucracy, as we know it, no one likes that word now. But in 1780 and 1790, it was a breakthrough. It said that rather than a decentralized, chaotic system that was difficult to keep track of, you would have bureaus, bureaucracy. You would have people working in those who were kind of interchangeable parts. You would have systems of management and hierarchy that were supposed to make things work better. And even though people communicate very differently now, we have very, very different management systems, I think the origins of the government we have now and the way it operates are really rooted in the 1890s.
One last final question, because this is kind of how we brought you in, was looking at appointments.
Right.
So look with us at what the founders intended
right.
for these appointments and maybe the Senate's power and what we have today.
So I'll begin by saying that I'm happy to be talking about this now, but if anybody wants to learn about this, they can go to cfg1789.wustl.edu. That's short for Creating a Federal Government, 1789, and then it's at Washington University, which is where I teach. So you can find out all of this. This is part of a digital project that's specifically designed to enable anybody to learn about their early government, to see all these stories. But yeah, during this time, there were over 5,000 nominations to civil office alone. And in his first term, George Washington physically went to the Senate to discuss it. He said, "The Constitution says we need advice and consent. I've come to seek the advice of the Senate." And the senators were furious. They claimed, "You've come to seek our advice, but we think you've come to demand our consent." Washington left, never to return, and he did everything through the mail. But here's the crucial thing. Right now, there's a lot of discussion about whether the president, whether an incoming president, specifically the incoming president, should appoint people as recess appointments. And the founders were strongly opposed to that. Occasionally, someone would resign, somebody would die, and the president would make a recess appointment, but they generally believed very strongly that the maximum number of officials should undergo advice and consent, that it was there for a reason. It was there to prevent a president from becoming a tyrant, and it was there to convince the American public that there was oversight, that there was review. And the senators saw it the same way. It became a constant part of their day-to-day work. And it really was a big part of a senator's job during this early period of U.S. history.
What's that website again?
Thank you. CFG1789, Creating a Federal Government, 1789.wustl.edu. You can also type creatingafederalgovernment.wustl.edu.
Well, thank you so much. Appreciate you coming in studio this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
That is Peter Kaster, professor of history at WashU, joining us this morning.